Democrats generally nominated less crazy people on their side for their Senate candidates. The Republicans nominated more crazy people because Trump has so much influence in the Republican primary. And so the American people, for once, I think, said, okay, we're going in the wrong direction. Let's actually try to do something about it.
ברוכים הבאים למרקרים, פודקאסט סוף השבוע של דה מרקר. ההזדמנות שלכם לקחת פסק זמן ממחזור החדשות היומיומי ולצלול איתנו לאירועים, לאנשים ובעיקר לרעיונות מאחורי החדשות. כאן באולפן איתכם כבלי שבוע גיא רולניק. והפעם אני איתכם בניו יורק, למהדורה מיוחדת של הפודקאסט הזה של המרקרים לסיכום בחירות האמצע, המידטרמס בארצות הברית. שם הייתה בשבוע האחרון הפתעה עצומה. כאשר הרפובליקנים שהיו אמורים להשתלט על שני הבתים, בית הנבחרים והסנאט, נחלו מפלות צורבות בכל המדינה. זה עדיין לא מבטיח לדמוקרטים כמובן את הבחירות ב-2024, רחוק מזה, אבל זה נותן להם רוח גבית עצומה לשנתיים הקרובות, וגם עשוי להנחית מכה קשה על דונלד טראמפ, שהיה רוח החיה בבחירות האלה, כאשר הוא תמך ברבים מהפוליטיקאים שהפסידו כישלון חרוץ בבחירות האחרונות. כדי להבין מה בדיוק קרה במידטרמס, מדוע הן הפתיעו, ומה המשמעות שלהם לפוליטיקה האמריקאית וגם לכלכלה האמריקאית, מצטרף אליי כאן לפודקאסט הבוקר במנהטן, ברדלי טאסק, שהוא היזם והמנהל של קרן ההון סיכון טאסק ונצ'רס, אבל הוא גם יועץ פוליטי ושחקן במערכת הפוליטית האמריקאית שנים ארוכות. אבל קודם כל, הנה נשמע כמה קולות מהימים האחרונים, ואז נפנה מיד לברדלי.
While the press and the pundits are predicting a giant red wave, it didn't happen. And I know you were somewhat miffed by my obsessive optimism, but I felt good during the whole process. I thought we were going to do fine.
It wasn't a red wave, it was more like a red trickle. The Trump factor was real among independents, and especially helped drive Democratic base voters to the polls when there was a news of the former president perhaps jumping in to the 2024 arena.
Donald Trump had tried to make this night all about him, his Republican Party, his candidates, his vision. But it's been a tougher sell than he, the polls, or even the Democrats expected. At just after 10 p.m. at his resort in Florida, the former president had felt confident enough to take to the podium.
I'd like to welcome the fake news media, which is back there.
ואני רץ הביתה, אני כולי רועט בכל הגוף, פורץ בבכי וצועק לאמא, אמא, אמא, הם הורסים הכל, הם שורפים הכל. זה היה משהו נורא. איזה הרגשה יש לילד? ילד בן 11, יהודי, שרואה את זה. מה הוא חושב? מה הוא יכול לחשוב?
עושים זיכרון, הפודקאסט של יד ושם, בפרק מיוחד לציון ליל הבדולח. להאזנה לפרק ולפרקים נוספים, חפשו את עושים זיכרון בכל אפליקציות הפודקאסטים.
Hello, Bradley, and welcome to our podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Before we start, I know you tend to talk very fast, so for the benefit of our listeners, try to slow it down in the next 30 minutes.
See, I would think this. So your listeners are Israeli, mainly, and I am a New York Jew, and I don't think I talk faster than other New Yorker. So my gut is that even though it's a second language, because the majority of Americans that your people talk to are probably New York Jews like me, they'll be fine.
Okay, we'll see. We'll see. I'll let you know during the podcast. So usually this is where we thank you for joining us in our studio, but today we are in your studio here in Lower East Side of Manhattan. So, Bradley, before we start, tell us about this place. We are in a studio inside a newly minted bookstore in New York. Are you trying to compete with Jeff Bezos?
No. I think even when Jeff Bezos did books, he that was never his plan to make money. I've always loved books. I've written a book. I created a thing a few years ago called the Gotham Book Prize. Had always thought it would be fun to own a bookstore one day. And then when COVID hit and New York City lost about 500,000 retail jobs, it kind of hit me that if you're going to do something nice for the city from a retail perspective, I could do it when I'm 70, which is what I had kind of had in the back of my mind. I could do it at 49 where I am now, and I'm going to lose money either way, so I might as well just do it now. So I want to try to do something a little different, kind of in keeping with the other types of work that I do. So it's an indie bookstore on the Lower East Side of Manhattan. It is also a podcast studio that anybody can use for free. As far as our research shows, it is the only one of its kind in the world that anyone can just walk in and use.
Fantastic. So we will go back to your ventures and business later. But now we move on to current events, the midterms, of course. And we are recording this podcast Monday morning after the results of the Nevada Senate race. And it is now clear that the Democrats have clinched a majority in the Senate. They're also heading toward dramatically better results in the House. So I know a lot of people, especially pollsters, that were really surprised from the results of these elections. Were you also?
Yeah, I think that everyone was expecting a red wave. And I think, generally speaking, just historically, the opposition party tends to do much better in the midterm elections than the Republicans did here. So when you combine that with this overall sense of anxiety and anger and polarization that we have in this society, you really expected people to sort of flip to the other extreme. I think the Democrats got very lucky in that there's a schism within both parties, but within the Republican Party particularly, it's between Trump and everyone else. And because Trump still has so much influence in Republican primaries, he was able to push through lots of really extreme, really flawed candidates. And the best news that came out of this election, from my point of view, was that the voters rejected extremism. So, for example, all the Secretary of State candidates that Trump supported, all of whom basically said, I will make sure Trump is certified as the winner of our state if in 2024 they all lost, thank God. So this seemed like for the first time in a while that the American voters exhibited some awareness of how bad things are and some awareness of how their inability to participate in the system seriously and take it seriously and elect people who actually want to get stuff done, they finally seem to grasp that a little bit. And so I think we got to a better result. And by the way, I'm an independent. I don't like either party. So it's not even that the good news to me is that Democrats won. It's just that extremists lost. If all the Republican extremists lost, but 50 new AOCs were minted, I would still find it just as problematic.
Okay, we'll go back to AOC maybe later. So given the surprising result, what would you say is the main message coming out of the result to the American people? What did we learn that we didn't understand last week?
I mean, I think we learned a few things. I think we confirmed yet again that polling is a completely broken industry and should not be relied upon very much. I think we learned that people are a little more aware and in tune than I think we thought. I think that one of the mistakes that political experts make all the time is they think that if they just poll test some slogans and throw them at voters, voters will just Pavlovianly respond to those in whatever way they so choose. And they did that, right? Whether it was inflation and gas prices on the Republican side or Dobbs on the Democratic side. And the reality is that's not what happened, right? People took a more holistic view of this and said, we're in a terrible spot in this country, and electing more people who will further exacerbate the problem doesn't make sense. And they voted against that, right? And so the Democrats, to their credit, generally nominated less crazy people on their side for their Senate candidates. The Republicans nominated more crazy people because Trump has so much influence in the Republican primary. And so the American people, for once, I think, said, okay, we're going in the wrong direction. Let's actually try to do something about it.
Okay. And what happened to the red wave?
I mean, clearly it didn't happen. Here's the question. Let's assume that Trump didn't exist. Let's assume he just passed away after the 2020 election or acted like every other former president in history ever has and shuts the fuck up. Can I curse on your podcast?
Yeah, sure.
Great.
No worries.
So if that had happened, you probably would have had different candidates emerging for Senate, for the House, for state offices, governor, everything like that. And odds are a more moderate Republican candidate would have either brought out more Republican voters or not brought out as many Democratic voters in opposition. So absent Trump, they would have done a lot better.
Yeah. So all, as you mentioned, almost all of the candidates that Donald Trump backed have lost Congress, governors, and even Secretary of States so that he backed. So this is the end of Donald or even the end of Trumpism?
From your lips to God's ears, but no. There's something about him that just always defies the laws of political gravity. And every time we're ready to write his political obituary, it turns out to be premature. So I hope so. And it's funny, you know, you get the question now of, well, do you really prefer Ron DeSantis? He's just as extreme. And my answer is, you know, I wouldn't want either of them to be president. I wouldn't vote for either of them. But the problem with Trump is that he adds such an extra layer of anxiety to day-to-day life because he's so unpredictable and so narcissistic and so psychologically just deficient in so many different ways that you just don't know what will happen, right? Ron DeSantis is very conservative, and he's a politician, so he believes in whatever he needs to believe in to win office, just like all of them. But I don't wake up in the middle of the night thinking he might just randomly tell the, you know, grab the nuclear football and tell people to start pressing buttons. So I certainly hope so. And you're clearly seeing an effort by the Republican mainstream to start moving in that direction. You're seeing Republican elected officials do it. Most notably, you've seen the New York Post do it. The New York Post is often a harbinger because it's owned by, even though it's New York specific, it's owned by Rupert Murdoch. Murdoch owns Fox News. So the Post is at least a sign that Murdoch clearly does not want a revival of Trump. The question will be, can Fox News...
So they sort of started to following suit in the last couple of days. We see some more anti-Trump.
Yeah, a little bit. Look, but they tried that.
Testing the water.
They tried that after January 6th and it didn't work, right? You know, they lost viewers to Newsmax and whatever that other One America, whatever that thing's called. And at the end of the day, they care more about ratings and advertising revenue than they do about the American people or government or democracy or anything else. So if they can maintain their viewers and move away from Trump, then I think they'll do so. And I think that would be really good. But they may not be able to do that. And also, you know, for the same reason they're very successful, their personalities, the Hannitys, the Carlsons of the world, are kind of independently powerful. I don't think it's that easy for the producers to just to tell them what to say and what to think. And if they're resolutely sticking by Trump, you know, it's not just like at the New York Post, Murdoch just sends word down from on high, and that's what comes in the newspaper the next day. It's very simple. I think Fox News is a lot more complicated.
So Trump is still stronger than Murdoch at this point?
Right now, yes. I think that if Murdoch discovers that he can get away with taking the same tone on Fox News that he's taking in the New York Post right now. And by the way, it's interesting. They're attacking Trump kind of respectfully, trying to kind of push him out. But there's another variable here that seems to me in play that isn't getting discussed enough, which is Trump, of course, wants and needs attention at all times. Trump, of course, wants to be president because it is the most relevant, powerful job in the entire world. Trump is also under serious threat of indictment for January 6th and potential other things. Not to say that you can't indict someone who is a candidate for president, but when someone is the leading candidate for president of the opposition party, although as I'm saying this, I'm realizing that the listeners in Israel are laughing, but at least in the U.S. so far, there is reluctance to go ahead and do that because it looks so overtly political.
Well, you never know. You know, Bibi was before Trump in a couple of things, and maybe this is also...
yeah, maybe you win anyway. I think the difference is you know, accepting some pink champagne and cigars and whatever. The stuff that Bibi did, from what I can tell, was greedy and arrogant and vain and stupid, but it wasn't evil, right? Trying to overthrow the government of the United States, hang the vice president, and completely get rid of our democracy, that's evil as far as I'm concerned. So, you know, what Trump did, you know, was truly, truly despicable. morally despicable, which is why I actually think the Justice Department will move forward and indict him, even if he is a candidate for president. But one of the reasons Trump is pushing forward, I would argue, so aggressively is he's at least trying to mitigate the likelihood of an indictment. And the sooner he becomes a candidate, and I think he's supposed to make a big announcement about this tomorrow, the more he thinks that'll help him.
Okay, so let's talk about the other side, now, the other side of the aisle. Let's talk about the Democrats. So Biden is running in 2024.
Yeah.
He's going to be like 80 or more than 80.
He'll be 82. Okay. In 24, if he completes the term, he'll be 86, which, so Ronald Reagan, up until now, has been the oldest president to ever serve in office. He was 76 at the end of his term, and we all thought, if you remember back to then, that that was crazy, right? He was so old, so out of it. Now, here we are a full decade later, and I think the difference between 76 and 86 from a mental acuity standpoint is probably very different than like 32 to 42. But with that said, Biden did beat Trump. There is a comfort level about Biden with independents and moderates and people the Democrats have to win elections. Because the Republican nominee will probably be DeSantis or Trump or someone really extreme, even if the far left finds Biden insufficiently progressive, they're still going to turn out because they don't want the alternative. And so the truth is, he's their best candidate. Now, he's really old. Could he break a hip tomorrow and it's all over? Yeah. So who knows? And we know for sure that Kamala Harris will not have a clear path to the nomination. A few weeks ago, Gavin Newsom, who's the governor of California, said something small but I thought incredibly important, which was just he basically said to off the record at a fundraiser, but it got out, if Biden's not running, I'm definitely running. And what that did was it created a permission structure for all of the other Democrats to say, me too, right? Because if you think about it, Harris is the first female vice president, the first black vice president, the first Indian vice president, the first of a lot of things. And in theory, a party that's focused on identity politics as the Democrats ought to say, well, she's clearly going to be our candidate. But once one politician had the balls to say, I don't care, I'm in, you know, 20 more will follow.
So if Biden doesn't run for some reason, who among the candidates do you think have the best chances?
Well, here's what I learned, and I wrote this in my column, I think in the Daily News not too long ago, which is people like you and me and probably the listeners of this podcast are in some ways the worst people to answer that question because we're too analytical and we're too intellectual. And so we sit here and say to ourselves, oh, Gretchen Whitmer, who's the governor of Michigan, she's a woman, she's kind of moderate, she'll get the Midwest, that's great. Pete Buttigieg, he comes from the Rust Belt, but he's gay, that'll unite people, that makes sense. And we keep talking ourselves into these combinations as to why the candidate who called and asked us for money and was nice to us and now we want to be helpful to them is the right candidate on paper. But the right candidate on paper is not the candidate that wins, right? The candidate that wins is the candidate that connects emotionally with the voters, right? Hillary Clinton was always the right candidate on paper, right? And she never won. She didn't beat Obama. She didn't beat Trump. She barely beat Bernie Sanders. She doesn't resonate emotionally with people. Now, that resonating can come in different ways, right? It can be hope and excitement like Obama, right? Or I think Reagan. I think those are sort of the epitome of Bill Clinton of that. Or it could be fear, right? So not that Biden is a fear mongerer, but when COVID hit, you know, Sanders had won three of the four primaries. He really was the leader. And then the minute that people realized, holy shit, this is a massive global pandemic, Sanders went away. They're like, there's no way we're putting this guy in charge of absolutely anything, right? Or here in New York City, you know, in 1993, Rudy Giuliani became mayor because crime was incredibly high. And typical Democratic voters who usually just voted for a left-wing candidate said, I'm sick of feeling scared, and they voted for Rudy. So it's the candidate that connects emotionally, and you don't know who that's going to be until some time passes. You just have to see how it's going. And so if Biden runs, it's pretty easy because that's who you're going to support if you're a Democrat or many independents too like me. But let's just assume that he does, for whatever reason, pass away or just can't run. I think the lesson that I've learned is I'm going to take my time before I pick a presidential candidate. And, you know, not that my endorsement's all that important, but I can raise a lot of money. So therefore, they're all calling and they all want money. So, but I really think the right answer is to not talk yourself into the math, but to see just kind of who in a visceral way can connect with the voters.
Okay, so tell us about John Fetterman. So how did he take Pennsylvania? And is some people say he's the answer of Democrats to the blue collar middle class voters that shifted in the last years to Trump.
Sure. So to the extent that the listeners aren't familiar with John Fetterman, he is still, until he takes office in January, the lieutenant governor of Pennsylvania. What makes him notable is he doesn't look like your typical kind of weeny Yale educated Democrat, right? He's like 6'7", he's got a shaved head, he's got a goatee, he drives a motorcycle, he wears a hoodie. He at least affects a commonality with the average person. I think in reality that may not be true. I think he's Jewish and I think he had a trust fund, so he might actually be more at home on the Upper East Side in many ways, but he looks the part. And the question is, can Democrats start to recapture white working class voters? And not just white working class voters, but you know what? Cristobal Alex, who was on our podcast last week, made this point really well. Latino voters are a lot like white working class voters. They, you know, Democrats make this assumption that because their skin is brown, they're automatically super hyper progressive. And the reality is they're worried about jobs and safety and schools.
Yeah, we've seen some of them shifting to Trump in the last couple of years.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's partly why Trump won Florida. And so, you know, is there a need for the Democrats to capture that? Yeah, there's only so far you can go with African-Americans and coastal elites. Is Fetterman the actual answer or just sort of the latest sort of, you know, Barbie doll that the media puts up there? We'll see.
So before we move to a couple of questions about the economy and business, let's first understand the political situation. So
sure.
With control of the Senate, what can Biden achieve?
Not much. So here's the thing. Despite all of the punditry around who's going to win the House, who's going to win the Senate, from a macro perspective, once one chamber flipped, the rest didn't really matter because the Democrats didn't get a ton done in the last years, but they got some stuff done. They got an infrastructure bill done. They got a climate change bill done. They got, you know, the CHIPS bill on semiconductors done. So they got a few things done where they were able to marshal straight party line support and pass bills. Once the House or the Senate flipped to the Republicans, you can no longer do that. And then if anything were to pass at all, it has to be negotiated by partisan compromise. The House still looks like it will become Republican. It may by a much smaller majority. But nonetheless, for as long as Democrats live in this existential fear of being criticized on Twitter, or, which maybe hopefully won't exist in the near future, or MSNBC, or just terrified of the far left. So in theory, because you're going to have splits within the Republican Party in the House, a group of entrepreneurial Democrats could go to McCarthy, assuming he becomes the Speaker, and say, look, here's what we need. We'll give you the 12 votes, 15 votes, whatever it is. I think someone like Josh is incredibly well positioned to do that. But I think generally speaking, most members of Congress don't have the balls to defy the base, don't have the balls to take the heat and take the criticism. They think that they do, but all they really mean is to take the heat and criticism from the opposite party, who doesn't matter to them anyway. And so there's a real opportunity now with a Democratic Senate, a Republican House, but a Republican House with a very, very small majority, and a relatively centrist president in Joe Biden to get some things done. However, if you were betting on whether or not Congress will produce anything meaningful in the next 2 years, I would strongly advise you to put your money on no.
All right. So before we talk about business and the economy, please tell our listeners your story.
I'm going to tell it through a couple of stories that I think ultimately really capture what happened. So the first is, I'm a first-generation American. You know, we didn't have a lot of money growing up, but in the summer of 1992 was the Democratic convention in New York City. It was the Bill Clinton nominating convention, and I had just finished my freshman year at Penn, and a guy that my dad knew was a lawyer for the Carpenters Union, and this guy, Brian O'Dwyer, God bless him, called me, said, hey, look, I can get you like a carpenter. I know you really love politics. I can get you a carpenter's pass. Do you want to go to the convention? I was like, oh, yeah, absolutely, right? So I put on a suit. I go to his office, I pick up the pass, And if you look in the newspaper, it says convention noon to midnight. Now, having been to some of these, it's really like 8 to 10:30 p.m. and that's it. But I didn't know that. So I show up at the garden at noon and there's nobody there, right? Like two guys running from state rep in Montana are speaking and the place is totally empty. But a guy named Ed Rendell, who at the time was the mayor of Philadelphia, was sitting in the audience by himself. And I've asked him half a dozen times over the succeeding years why, and he just never remembers. And I kind of worked up the courage to go say hi. And I said, you know what? He was actually a Jewish guy from New York before he moved to Philly. So am I. He went to Penn. I go to Penn. He's the mayor of Philadelphia. I go to school in Philadelphia. What's the worst that can happen? And Rendell, being actually a really nice man and really gregarious, was thrilled to talk to me because I was a kid who was sort of worshiping him and it was more interesting than the empty seat next to him. And so we talked for about 10 minutes and he said, are you busy when you get back to school? I said, no, not particularly. He said, do you want an internship? I said, oh, that'd be incredible. Thank you. And he said, okay, send me a note. We'll set it up. I go home. I write a letter. Every day I open the mailbox, nothing. And what I know now but didn't know then is correspondence is a black hole of government, right? Everything goes in, nothing comes out. In fact, we invested in a company called IndieGov out of our venture capital fund that I think actually solving that problem, which to me was particularly exciting, but never get a response. School year starts, and I don't know what I was thinking, but I was like, I'll go see him. This is a decade before 9/11, so security is nowhere near what it is today. So I get to his outer office, so not like his actual scheduler and people, but like kind of the front desk. And I said, oh, can I see the mayor? And they were bewildered by that question, right? Because the only two people ever asked that question were people protesting, right? I didn't have a TV camera behind me or anything, or genuinely crazy people. And I wasn't crazy. I was just a sort of naive 18-year-old kid. They said, oh, he's busy running the city. I said, okay, can I leave a note? They said, sure. And I'm on the subway back to the dorm. I'm like, you fucking idiot. You can't just go see the mayor. I kind of write it off my head. Get to the dorm. 15 minutes later, the phone rings. Please hold for the mayor. He said, when are you coming to work? I'll be there in 20 minutes. And that was my start in politics. Then ended up after that, I was a spokesman for the New York City Parks Department after college and the senior advisor to the commissioner there after law school. Then became Chuck Schumer's communications director in the U.S. Senate. Went to City Hall, worked for Mike Bloomberg as a special assistant. Then got this crazy job as the deputy governor of Illinois, where at the age of 29, I was running the state's budget operations, policy, legislation, and communication, a job that I was in no way qualified for, but I think I did okay. And then my final job in politics was running Mike Bloomberg's mayoral campaign in 2009. And so pretty good run there. And then when I pivoted into tech and business, kind of similar story of luck, which is I started my first company in 2010, consulting firm that runs big campaigns. So imagine you're Walmart, you want to open up stores in four major downtowns, and you've got union issues and community issues and all kinds of stuff like that, land use. We figure all that stuff out. And I'm sitting in a meeting early 2011, so it's about a year into my first business, and a friend of mine called and said, hey, listen, there's this guy with a small transportation startup. He's having some regulatory problems. Would you do me a favor and talk to him? Okay. I become Uber's first political advisor later that day. I get really lucky when Travis Kalanick, who was the founder and CEO, calls me back and says, listen, I can't afford your fee. We'll just take equity. I had no idea what equity meant, but thank God I said yes. That was back during the Series A. Spent the better part of the next few years running campaigns all over the U.S. to legalize Uber and ride sharing. And we won in every single jurisdiction in the country because we figured out how to take advantage of the key learning that I had in my 15 years working directly in government and politics, which is every policy output is the result of a political input. So all things being equal, you're a city councilman in Tulsa, right? Taxi industry gives you a couple of grand a year campaign contributions. Your former chief of staff is a lobbyist for them. You do what they want, right? That's basic politics. Now, I just had 6,000 of your constituents email, tweet, text, call you saying, leave this thing alone. I like this. And the political input shift drastically. It goes from, oh, I'll take care of the donors and the tax industry to holy shit. These are people who are never paying attention and they're paying attention to this. I'm not going to piss them off. And by changing the input, we change the output and the outcome in every single jurisdiction in the U.S. And then ultimately kind of got me into technology. I repeated the process with Clear, which is a biometric screening company that helps you kind of move through the airport faster, took equity, got them into a bunch of airports, met my partner Jordan, who was running Blackstone's internal venture fund at the time, we realized that, you know, if you truly understood regulatory risk and could do something about it, it would make you a better investor. And we didn't know how much, 10%, 20%, 30%, but we believed it was something. And on the strength of that very flimsy belief, we went out, it took us 2 years, but raised our first venture capital fund. It was a tiny fund, $35 million, started investing it at the end of 2016. But we did really well. FanDuel, Lemonade, Bird, Coinbase, Circle, Nexar, Roman, just lots and lots and lots of good companies. Doubled the fund size to $70 million in 2019, did it again, went really heavy into digital health for that fund. And then the pandemic hit, and turns out, you know, the value proposition of telemedicine became vastly more understood as a result. That fund has done exceptionally well. Raised our third fund, doubled it again to $140 million. Announced it back this past April. And we're investing out of Fund 3 right now. And we remain the only venture capital fund that not only gives you money, but we solve your political problem. So when we look at deals and we invest early stage, so seed and Series A, we look at all the same stuff that any VC would. Then we ask two more questions. One, is there a gating regulatory issue or opportunity that if it were solved could really drive growth and valuation? And if so, two, can we solve it? And when the answer is yes to both of those questions, that's when it really makes sense for us to deploy capital. And when the answer is yes to both of those questions, the founder really wants us to be in the deal because we're the only one that can solve that problem. And as I make clear to them, I still have the consulting firm. You can gladly pay them $1 million a year and they'll solve your problem for you too. Or I can give you millions of dollars and solve your problem for free. Not shockingly, we see a lot of deals. We win a lot of deals. I've got a monopoly in my tiny little niche of venture capital. And so that's my day job.
So you mentioned Bradley, Lemonade, and Nexar. Those are two Israeli companies. Tell us about your experience with Israeli entrepreneurs.
Yeah, I haven't been there since the pandemic, which is a bummer because I was going probably twice a year before that. One other thing, and I've said this publicly before, that I really like about Israeli startups, and there are exceptions, Adam Newman, I guess, being the poster child on this one.
Have you ever met the guy?
I never have, actually, and I really would prefer not to.
How was he able to get $28 billion from Masoyashi-san?
A combination of he's a hell of a salesman, right? Like, really a world-class salesman. Obviously, is a really, really talented, brilliant man. But we all get felled by our own arrogance and by our own brilliance. And I think he was told so many times how brilliant he was that he believed that any thought that popped into his head was automatically a genius idea. When you commit to a valuation of $47 billion, whatever it was for WeWork, literally and sign a deal on the back of a napkin after one meeting, that's pretty shitty diligence, and he paid a heavy price for it. But generally speaking, it's the opposite, which is everyone at that startup, from the founder on down to everyone else, has already served in the military, right? Everyone spent at least 2 years serving their country, learning discipline. And as a result, if nothing else, they're just more mature, right? And that's a lot easier to deal with than the kind of temper tantrum-laden Stanford graduate who was in Y Combinator, who has been kind of coddled their entire life and never dealt with anything truly hard. And the minute the shit hits the fan, they can't handle it, right? So for that reason, I really do enjoy working with Israeli entrepreneurs. And I am, because I know that they have a reputation for being a huge pain in the ass, but what I would say is I got very lucky that, generally speaking, Israeli founders, when it comes to U.S. politics, media, and regulation, they know what they don't know. They understand. They don't know this. I do. I'm the Bloomberg guy. I'm the Uber guy. And so while they might be difficult to work with in other areas, in my area, I've actually found them pretty easy.
So you did mention Adam Neumann. So I can't, while you were talking about Adam Neumann, I said, okay, now there is another space where there is a big debacle. And of course, this is Sam Bankman-Fried. So yeah. Let's talk a little bit about what's happening in the last weekend in the crypto world. Do you think that the demise of FTX is going to be like a watershed moment in the crypto world, and now we're entering like a really bad time for the entire space.
So I hope not, simply because even though I don't personally hold any crypto, and my fund, we only ever made two crypto-related investments, Coinbase and Circle, and those both have done really well, I do think that crypto serves a useful purpose in the marketplace, but I think that that purpose has been wildly misunderstood and overstated, which is, to me, at its core, and I think this is what, you know, Satoshi Nakamoto meant when she, he, whoever that person is, wrote their white paper, you know, a dozen years ago about crypto, there are a lot of people who just don't have trust in their central government, in their central bank. If you think about it, really since the start of the Vietnam War, trust in institutions, both in this country and then globally, have plummeted, right? So pre-Vietnam, people generally trusted the government. They generally trusted the media. They trusted the church. They trusted higher ed. They trusted Wall Street. Now no one trusts any of those institutions whatsoever. So there's at least some group of people who will say ideologically, look, I don't trust the Federal Reserve. I don't trust Jerome Powell. I don't trust Janet Yellen or Joe Biden. I would rather throw my lot in with people who I'll never meet because it's all anonymous, but share similar ideological views to me, and we can transact through Bitcoin, Ethereum, whatever it is. And that will become especially relevant once the metaverse is here and it becomes easy to buy or purchase, you know, any good digital good or service, you know, through any type of cryptocurrency you want. But it's kind of a small use case, right? That's a, you know, is it a group of society? Sure. But I'd say that's, you know, what, 1-3% of the crypto world, and the rest of it are just people making a lick a buck, right? And that's okay. That's capitalism. But I think all this money, you know, hundreds of billions, if not trillions of dollars got poured into this system without investors understanding, look, you're just betting on momentum and an idea. There is no intrinsic value to any token whatsoever, right? Some might have a little bit in the sense that Bitcoin has a limited amount that can be mined, so supply demand. Ethereum is at least built on the blockchain, and the blockchain itself has a lot of value, I would argue, apart from finance and cryptocurrency and all of that. But generally speaking, I don't think people understood what they were getting into. They just sort of went for the latest craze. By the way, not just sort of average retail investors on Robinhood, but massive venture capitalists. Sequoia had put up $216 million into FTX, and kind of everyone threw in with it. And I think what might happen now is at least a reckoning of, here's what this thing is, here's what it's not. It serves some useful purposes. I do think that once we get to a world of the metaverse, and I don't know if that's in 5 years or 15 years, but where the vast majority of transactions are being conducted digitally, that does create the opportunity for at least some tokens to become a true currency.
So if we're discussing the space of narcissistic entrepreneurs that are falling from grace, what do you think is going to happen now to our friend Elon? So it's now 2 weeks since Elon Musk bought Twitter. And if I'm following his Twitter feed in the last 72 hours, I think, Bradley, that he desperately needs a crisis communication advisor.
I know that he thinks that, but he doesn't. So I know Elon just a tiny bit. My consulting firm had Tesla as a client probably 6-7 years ago. And what they wanted was completely reasonable, which is they wanted to sell cars online. The U.S. in many states had these protectionist laws that force people to physically go to the dealer. And that is solely because the dealers provide, you know, political donations and whatever else to politicians. And so they kind of lock in their business model. But even then, I remember going to Elon and his team and saying, okay, guys, I think I can pass this law for you in Texas, Michigan, Indiana, Connecticut, wherever it was in question. But the auto dealers are actually kind of popular, right? Like, they're fixtures in the community. They sponsor the Little League team. They sponsor the 4th of July parade. We're going to have to run a really rough fucking campaign to show who these guys truly are. And he said no. He did not want to take the risk to his brand. And by the way, fine, right? He certainly has done pretty well since then, so I'm not questioning his judgment. But even in a much kind of lower stake situation, and I'm considered pretty good at this communication stuff, when I gave him my advice, he didn't take it. They have fired their entire comms department right now. Yeah. You have to be a really desperate PR firm to take on Twitter as a client. So a couple of macro thoughts. One, there's nothing that would be better for society than Twitter going up in flames entirely. It is one of the most toxic platforms in the history of humanity. It has destroyed journalism, in my view. It has pushed our politics vastly to the extremes. It has incited tremendous amounts of hatred and violence. It is the absolute worst of the internet, or pretty damn close to it. Number one.
Just before you go there, just, you know, so Musk calls himself a free speech absolutist. So can you explain to our listeners why, in many way, when you say free speech absolutist, meaning you can say everything and this is just a platform, is a recipe for the destruction of democracy?
It doesn't even mean anything, right? Like, your question offers him way too much credit, right? So yes, we could have a discussion about that if free speech had no constraints at all, here are the risks that it entails and here's how it does imperil democracy. So we can have that conversation. But in reality, that's not what this is, right? Nobody spends $44 billion because they love the First Amendment. Elon Musk fell victim to the same thing that powerful people throughout time, starting with Icarus or even before. He became so desperate for attention, so desperate for validation, so addicted to not just the money, because the truth is, whether you have $2 billion or $200 billion, your life's really not that different, right? It gets hard to spend after a while. There's only so many stupid fucking things you can buy with it. And then at that point, what is it about? It's about power. It's about influence. It's about attention. Some people handle it reasonably well, like, say, a Warren Buffett, a Mike Bloomberg. But Elon, and look, he's different. He has 90 million Twitter followers. He is someone who wakes up every single day and says, how do I get that dopamine hit to make myself feel better about myself? And, you know, if you're a Russian oligarch, you buy a super yacht, but that can't do it for him anymore. So he needs to suddenly buy fucking Twitter, right? And yes, it worked. Here, you and I are sitting here 6 months after he announced the deal. We're still talking about it. So he achieved his goal of getting attention. But when you make decisions purely based on id, purely based on insecurity and ego and nothing else, they tend to be really bad decisions. So I would say he's no different than Kanye West. He's no different than Donald Trump. These are people for whom their desperation for relevance and attention drives all of their actions. And someone who's done some pretty great things for the world. Look, I've never launched anyone to space. I've never moved an entire industry towards, you know, electrification. But despite some really meaningful accomplishments, he's destroying himself simply because he can't control his own ego and he can't control his own security.
So what's going to happen on Twitter business-wise and communication-wise?
I mean, business-wise, I've never understood the business model to begin with, right?
Advertising.
No, I get it. But like, it doesn't – other platforms, Instagram, Facebook, TikTok, they lend themselves well to advertising, right? Twitter, just because of the way that it's structured and the way that it's used, it's a lot, you know, you have sponsored tweets, but it just doesn't hit consumers in the same way. It just doesn't seem to work. And look, you know this business a lot better than I do. So it was always a weak business model to begin with. And $44 billion, a lot of money. I think $26 billion is his personally, plus he just sold another $4 billion of Twitter shares to help have extra cash to shore up the balance sheet at Twitter. And yeah, they could cut staff by half like they have, and that might temporarily kind of staunch the bleeding. But overall, I'm not really sure what the business model is. And we talked about intrinsic value before. Twitter's only intrinsic value are the users, right? It has no other assets. So the minute the users decide, you know what, this is too much of a mess, this is too toxic, now that they're selling blue check marks, I have no idea who I'm even following or whether what they're saying is true or not, you do hit a risk of a point where people just decide, I'm not doing this anymore, right? Like, interestingly, journalists who seem to live on Twitter, and again, talk about people who desperately are insecure and need validation and affirmation, will do anything they can to get it. For them, it doesn't come from buying Twitter or running for president or, you know, saying what Kanye would say. It comes from getting likes and retweets, right? It's a much lower level of the same thing. And so they're addicted to it as well. It wouldn't be a particularly useful business, but if someone came along, created a platform for journalists where they could get the same affirmation and validation that they need to calm and quell their own insecurities that wasn't Twitter, they'd probably switch over. And once they do, And once all the different extremists do in either way and start talking to each other on other platforms, there's no real reason for Twitter to exist. So I am rooting for its full bankruptcy and demise.
Fantastic. So two last questions, one policy and one finance slash venture capital. So we start with policy. You mentioned AOC just for the benefit of our listeners. This is Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the hyper-progressive politician from New York. So last month in the talks that you gave to my students at UChicago, I heard you twice mentioning the need for what you called redistribution of wealth. So you mean basically probably more progressive taxes.
I don't actually.
Okay, go ahead.
So here's what I would say. I've spent a lot of time thinking about this, and I teach a class not totally different than guys at Columbia Business School called The Economics and Politics of Disruption. I actually spent my whole last class talking about this, which is, and this is sort of a complicated concept, but the world right now is statistically better than it has ever been by an exponential margin. The world feels worse than it ever has by an exponential margin. Thank you, Twitter. And so capitalism and democracy, the twin forces, have brought about so much innovation and so much wealth at the bottom quarter of society globally is in much better shape than they've ever been. It feels terrible because capitalism is still based on selling people things. The way they sell people things is to make them say your life is inadequate and you'll only feel better about yourself if you buy this toaster, you buy this makeup, whatever it is. And then because of Instagram and Twitter and everything else, we see what everyone else has that we don't have, right? Even if what they're showing you isn't actually real, and that makes people feel really bad. So we've got these forces of capitalism and democracy that overall, they work, right? I mean, look at Israel, right? Still a country that's very new, but by embracing capitalism and democracy, it has done exponentially better than most countries throughout all of history because of these systems that it was able to use. However, like every system, there are flaws in the system. And one problem of capitalism, especially in sort of a hyper-globalized technical world that we now live in, is that wealth tends to flow to a relatively small group of people at the expense of everyone else. And I would say, just like I made the point before, that whether Elon Musk or anyone has $200 billion or $2 billion, your life isn't really any different, right? How much money can you spend? I don't have that kind of money, but I've done pretty well. I have more money than I need. Now, I personally give away the vast majority of it through the programs that touch philanthropies, like Solving Hunger, like mobile voting. Even this bookstore we're sitting in is a massive money pit that I'm doing just because I love New York and want to try to do something good for the city. But overall, money has to go from people like me to people who don't have enough. Nobody should be struggling to put food on the table. No one should be living without the ability to pay the gas bill and they're living in freezing cold. There's so many things that both people in this country and all over the world, indignities they have to suffer simply from a lack of basic resources, and that shouldn't exist. So that then brings you to the question of what is the best way to solve that inequality? So there's really two mechanisms. One would be what you mentioned, which is progressive taxation and government. I've run governments. I feel like I really understand this as well as anyone's probably going to. Government is very good at certain things. So if you're taking a big collective action need, building a road, fielding a military, something like that, you have to have government because individuals can't really do it on their own. But there's a lot of other things where, you know, we have all kinds of government programs, whether it's around social services or jobs or, you know, anything else that we're not that good at, right? And we're not that good at, if nothing else, because we have this giant bureaucracy that sucks so much money off the top. So I pay a dollar in taxes. I want that dollar to go to someone who doesn't have enough money to put food on the table for their kids. The dollar on taxes first, then money gets taken off the top because it gets appropriated elsewhere. Then you have this giant bureaucracy that basically exists for the good of the bureaucracy itself and the good of the unions that control it. Then it goes into some sort of program that may or may not be effective. And some programs are very effective, like school meals, and some are ineffective. So what's gating to that family? 30 cents on the dollar, 40 cents on the dollar? So I sort of a tech stereotype, I guess, but I do believe in universal basic income. And I know that in some ways, because of, you know, Silicon Valley embracing it, it has become a little bit of a meme. But Martin Luther King is the person that first proposed this. And, you know, I think that I would rather have less money personally and just see it go into a mechanism where my dollar goes directly into someone else's bank account that they can use for what they see fit. And will a small percentage wasted on cocaine? Sure. You know, but will 98% of people feed their families, pay their rent, pay off student loans, you know, build some savings, whatever it is? Absolutely. And so to me, we now have the technology to be able to kind of bypass government and just help people directly. It would be a far more efficient system of doing so. And so I would like to see a redistribution of wealth. I would just rather than seeing 50, 60, 70% of the money get wasted on nonsense, I'd rather see 100% of the money go to helping people. And as a result, I would prefer a system like UBI compared to progressive taxation.
So you did move a little closer to AOC in the last 10 years.
Yeah, well, look, I didn't have any money 10 years ago. Keep in mind, you know, my first job in politics, the personal one, I made $22,000 a year. I've only made money in the last 10, 12 years, and I have enough, right? And the vast, vast majority of the money I make now just goes to the things that I care about, like hunger, like voting. But if you told me that those problems could be solved without my foundation having to do anything, because now we are directly giving people the resources they need to solve their own problems, fucking great.
Okay, last question, prediction 2023, VC startups money. Are we heading into a nuclear winter? You
no.
just raised the fund.
Yeah.
You need to deploy money. What's
yeah, right, take? Which is why I don't think we are, right? There is so much cash in the system. There are so many VC funds that need to deploy money. And there are so many institutional investors that are still taking in so much capital that has to go somewhere. So will there be less institutional money allocated to VC than before? Probably. Have the nature of fundraising and deals within VC changed a little bit over the past, say, 10 months? Yes. If nothing else, we were living in this absurdity where you'd have an initial meeting with a founder and then be told you had to submit a term sheet an hour later. And it's like, I haven't even met anyone else there. I haven't looked at this thing. Our fund actually invested at an incredibly slow pace in 2021 and the beginning of 2022. Now that we're seeing valuations decline a little bit and we're seeing some rationality emerge back into the system, we have picked up our pace quite a bit. We had three deals we've closed in the past 2 weeks. And so I do think because there's so much capital out there, all of the good ideas will get funded. I think where you'll see stuff fall by the wayside is when people create startups that aren't solving a problem in the first place, simply because they just think it'd be cool to have a startup and they want to make a lot of money. Clearly, crypto is going to have a hard time. Web3, to a certain extent, may suffer alongside of it. I think the nature of venture capital funds itself will change a little bit, right? So I think you've got your big mammoth, your Sequoias, your Andreessens, your NEAs of the world that have billions and billions of dollars under management, and they'll be okay simply because LPs want to be in those funds, right? So they'll have money to invest. You have smaller funds like mine that are very differentiated, right? There's a lot of mid-sized generalist funds that neither provide any sort of really specific value add to their portfolio companies, nor do they have the sort of weight and power of a giant fund. And I think those funds are going to have a really hard time raising from institutional investors. You're going to see a lot of, more so than seeing lots of startups fail, I think you're going to see a bunch of VCs fail.
Bradley Tusk, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
עד כאן המרקרים להשבוע. תודה רבה לכל הצוות שהפיק את הפודקאסט המיוחד הזה מניו יורק ועד שוקן. קודם כל המפיק שלנו אמיר פקטור. תודה רבה להוגו, הטכנאי המקומי כאן ב-Lower East Side. תודה לדן ברומר שערך, ותודה רבה לברדלי טאסק שהצטרף אלינו לשיחה הנהדרת הזאת. תודה רבה גם לעידו פולק שנתן פה תמיכה רוחנית חשובה בכל ההקלטה. ולהתראות בשבוע הבא.